Ryan Seacrest here. So every great barbecue takes a little patience. And while the food does its thing, you can enjoy a little Chumba Casino. The perfect recipe. Chumba Casino. Always good to have you back.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome back to Chronicles, friends, where today we're going to be talking all about Childe Harold's Pilgrimage by Lord Byron, a man who was described by one of his many, many lovers, Caroline Lamb, as mad, bad and dangerous to know. And as it so happens, my guest today fits just that description. Hello, Rory.
Hello, thank you for the compliment. I don't have the wealth or the lands, so...
Well,
a wee bit different, but
maybe one day your Byronic journey is yet to begin.
I'll go to Bath like his dad did and find a nice wife.
Yeah.
Oh, I shouldn't say that. I've already got a girlfriend, but anyway. All
right. Yeah. Anyway, right. So, thanks for coming on to talk all about Byron. We've been discussing doing this for quite some time, and it's been really good actually because it's allowed me to. I've read several of the cantos, you know, many times over at this point. I've been able to just really, really stew in them and, you know, think about what Byron's trying to communicate with this poem. And so it's great to have the opportunity to now sit down and discuss it.
Yeah, definitely.
So I suppose one of the first things to talk about before we talk about anything to do with the poem itself is the fact that Byron was a singular figure, right? He was a man who was really the first celebrity.
Yeah. Yeah.
His own wife, Anne Milbank, who in herself had been one of his little, you know, his groupies, you know, and everything, and ended up marrying him, poor woman. She ended up coining the term Byromania.
Yeah. You
know, long before there was ever Beatlemania, there was Byromania.
And long before Oscar Wilde, who,
yes,
for some reason, a lot of people think to be the first celebrity. You know, Oscar Wilde was fundamentally copying Byron. Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Yes.
So,
and that's something that, so Childe Harold's Pilgrimage can really be seen as the genesis for where that celebrity status began.
Yeah.
It's something that, so he went on a lad's holiday, you know, went on the grand tour as, sons of aristocrats and people from noble families used to do back then after your university years.
Him and his pal, Hobhouse.
Yeah.
From Cambridge. Yeah.
You'd go out to Spain or to France or to Italy and you'd get to know the world. You'd look at civilization. Mm. You'd take in experiences that were supposed to cultivate you.
Well, you go and see the ruins of antiquity. You go and visit what was civilization.
Yes.
Before the Dark Ages.
Right. However, for Byron in his own particular time, this was all rather complicated because there was that little minor event known as the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars going on.
Yeah.
So what would have traditionally have been a trip going through France into Italy onto Greece, in this case, had to be taken around Spain.
Yes.
And so what Childe Harold's Pilgrimage is the most romantic, poetic travelogue you've ever read.
Mm.
And that is really something that I want to stress to people. Just in this one poem alone, Byron demonstrates himself to be an absolute master of the English language.
Mm.
It is truly a tour de force in writing. And so I'm looking forward to talking all about that a little later on. But of course, we can't really begin to discuss the ideas and the philosophies as Byron lays them out in this poem without actually discussing something about Byron himself and, of course, his family, because he had, after all, let's face it, a very colourful family tree.
Yeah, he's very... Byron is known to be, as you said, dangerous, scandalous, a bit of a degenerate by civil society standards.
By modern standards.
Even by modern standards. He slept with allegedly over 200 women.
From countesses to prostitutes,
And several men or boys.
Mm.
I don't know if it's several, but however many. But he was a rake from a long line of rakes, really. Mm. He basically all the men on his father's side of the family were similar in terms of scandal and degeneracy and immorality. His uncle, who held the title of Lord Byron. The Wicked Lord Byron was in possession of an estate called Newstead Abbey, which was a Augustinian priory, which was dissolved, obviously, in the Reformation. Given by Henry VIII. The actual line had come over with William the Conqueror.
Ralph de Beroun has come over.
Anyway, Newstead Abbey, the uncle had... whose name was, I think, the Wicked Lord Byron. I may be getting that confused. It might have been an earlier lord.
Yeah, it's William Byron.
William Byron.
Yeah.
He had taken the abbey. He'd built several follies along the lake of the abbey. And he used those follies essentially for orgies as well as for shooting cannons at from a boat he had on
miniature naval reenactments things like that.
Obviously his ancestors, Byron's grandfather, was similarly crazy as well as his father.
Yeah, this is John Foulweather Byron, who was infamously got his name because he'd always find his ship in just the worst winds and the worst storms that the ocean could possibly bestow. Yeah.
And his dad was called Mad Jack, who, again, basically cavorted around Europe and the world, shagging and, you know, treating his wives badly, really.
Yeah, burning through their inheritance.
Yeah.
So, first of all, Byron is the son of his father's second marriage.
Yeah.
Mad Jack Byron's first marriage was to Amelia Osborne, who was actually Marchioness of Carmarthen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that yielded one daughter.
Augusta
Lee. And Byron would go on to meet her.
Scandalous, incestuous relations with her.
Not the first time in the family line either.
No, before we get onto the cantos, you know, there's this running idea throughout Childe Harold that he's buried something behind him. There's a very early stanza in the canto
that he comes from a disreputable line of people.
Well, not even that, but there's a love interest in the background who he doesn't, or at least he, Childe Harold, this is at least, or at least the narrator alludes to it. Now, obviously, a lot of people see Byron as Childe Harold, although Byron denied this.
Yes,
and you know, personally, I think that Childe Harold is just a kind of immoral...
A narrative device
used by Byron to explore some themes within his own life, but is very much his own character. Mm. But anyway, this love interest was presaged analogous to Byron's own life with a cousin who was from the Duff line, which is another Scottish family, who was essentially Byron's first female love interest.
Mm.
And when she later married, he said he couldn't really deal with it, and he couldn't understand how he could ever feel this way about a woman again.
So Byronic.
Yeah.
So romantic.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a bit of a maelstrom, really, of romance and sodomy and all sorts of things for Byron.
And it's impossible to understand Byronism. It's impossible to understand his philosophy, his way of viewing the world, his opinions on all of the things that he encounters throughout Childe Harold's pilgrimage without understanding the genuinely volatile situation that he grew up in as a child. So obviously, as you pointed out, his father was a total rake. Even some might go as far as to say an absolute bounder.
Yeah.
In his second marriage, which was to Catherine Gordon.
Catherine Gordon.
The Clan Gordon.
Which is where Lord Byron George Gordon gets his name from.
Of Aberdeenshire.
Yeah.
And she in herself was a wealthy heiress.
What had happened was Mad Jack Byron's father, had obviously married, had a child, his wife then died.
Mm.
He needed a new wife.
Probably from exhaustion.
He needed a new wife, not only because you know, he wanted a wife, but because he was absolutely bankrupt.
Yeah.
So the place to go in those days, if you were the landed gentry and you needed a new wife with a good fortune, was to Bath. So he went to Bath, he met this 20-year-old heiress in the form of Catherine Gordon, married her quite quickly, and proceeded to basically ransack her estate.
Yeah.
In order to support his lifestyle and his debts. Obviously, Lord Byron, George Gordon, who we're discussing, came out of that. And quite quickly found himself as a child in quite, for an aristocrat at least, in quite deplorable living standards because of his father's actions and his mother's willingness to support them.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. And obviously his father passed away when he was very young. And also as well, even when the young Byron was alive, obviously it was in his mother's best interest to have the father as far away from home as possible.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he was often down south or he was in France, you know, just continuing.
Yeah, he went and remarried and
yeah,
he would come back every now and again on a Sunday. Always on a Sunday because that's
good
when...
Good Christian boy.
Because that was when debtors couldn't demand their debts back. He'd come on a Sunday to London because Byron and his mother moved to London and lived in a back room above a shop, I think. Not to say it was squalor. You know, it was dignified, but it wasn't what you'd expect of an aristocratic family.
It certainly wasn't the sort of future that Byron's mother thought she had in store for herself.
Yeah, especially since she had 65,000 in her estate, around that amount, which was a lot of money, like millions. I think very soon into their marriage, Mad Jack Byron had squandered at least half of that. And they had to sell vast amounts of the estate to do so. Mad Jack was turning back up in London and demanding more money, blah, 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 blah. Byron spent most of his younger years in London at a school, which I believe was basically in a cellar, where he didn't receive much of an education. It was just very strict, dogmatic Christian teachings. He also had a club foot, which compounded things.
Yeah, from birth.
Yeah, and they could have had it treated if they caught it earlier, but you know, because they didn't
couldn't
have the money.
Couldn't afford it.
Couldn't afford it.
Father had spent it.
There was a couple of nursemaids involved, one of whom was a very strict Calvinist. So this is partly where he developed his antipathy towards sort of original sin and organized forms of institutional Christianity and religion itself.
Yeah.
They then went back up to Edinburgh, he and his mother, where he sort of developed this sense that he was born half Scot, but he was basically fully Scot. There's an account where someone came in and said, oh, he's so pretty, but it's a shame about his club foot. And he grabbed a horse whip and said, didn't mention it, and whipped her. But there was another nursemaid as well, who was Agnes Gray, was the Calvinist nursemaid, and her sister, who I think was a Presbyterian, started abusing Byron at the age of 9. Or around that time.
Sexually abusing him.
Which is where Byron himself later on alludes to this and says this is where his passions originated from at an extremely young age. His passions that would go on to see him sleep with 200 aristocratic wives and numerous other people. So, yeah.
Yeah. So a very, very unconventional upbringing. And it's definitely easy to see where the demons of his youth would go on to form the man of the future. But the other thing as well is that it wasn't all misfortune because, of course, eventually when Byron was just 10 years old, his great uncle passed away, the one who was...
Held the estate and held the title.
Yeah, William Byron, the wicked lord,
passed
away. And his own son, the one who should have inherited from him, had died at war in Corsica back in the 1770s. So now, after that, Byron became the heir apparent.
He was hit by a cannonball, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so now we find 10-year-old Byron coming into his inheritance now at Newstead Abbey, which had been left in a state of total disrepair.
Yeah, had been ransacked by bailiffs and
whatnot.
Yeah, all the great oaks had been cut down by Byron's father's father, or at least Byron's another distant relation who had again run out of money, so decided to kill 2,000.
I know it's a pattern here.
Yeah, 2,700 deer he killed on the property to sell to the local markets, and he cut down all the trees to sell for wood. So
Yeah. But actually within that as well, in that arrival at Newstead Abbey, it would have been a profound experience for Byron, and one of his first experiences with living a life filled with Gothic elements,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Seeing this abbey left that had been violated by Henry VIII and then his own ancestors as well, to see this abbey in decay,
in
ransacked,
ruins, yeah.
to see things in ruin, and the genuinely sublime beauty that offered, you know, was obviously left a very, very powerful impression on him. And then as we go into Byron's years of proper education at Harrow, yeah. and then at Cambridge as well, you see this young boy who had been born with the club foot and by all descriptions seemed to have been a little bit on the chubby side as a young boy, actively willing himself, taking decisions about his own life and saying, no, this is the sort of man I want to be. This is going to be my brand. This is a persona I'm going to put out into the world. And so you see a man all of a sudden who went from a bit chubby to actually getting a real hell of a physique on him.
Yeah.
Someone that basically, by all accounts, apparently had an absolutely beguiling voice as well. He was incredibly handsome. It almost reminds me, in a way, actually, of how Henry Cavill, right, his old school friends used to call him Fatty Cavill, and now he's regarded as like one of the most handsome men in Hollywood, right? That but kind of a transformation.
He became quite a sportsman. Even when he arrived at Newstead, I think he found his uncle's pistols. So he was always interested in shooting. He was a very, very good swimmer. He swam the Dardanelles.
One of his proudest moments of his life.
Yeah, and the Hellespont, I think.
Yeah.
And several estuaries and sort of places you shouldn't swim. So he was very, very fit, and he didn't let his foot do him down, really.
No. And also as well, it became that there was so much about Byron that people became enamoured or obsessed or just fascinated by, that the foot became a triviality, right? And this is the point. He just basically overrid any of the things that would have otherwise been, oh, you've seen that guy with the club foot, to just create such a persona around himself.
But he kind of used it to animate himself as well. Like, obviously, he was extremely self-conscious of it, but he sort of transmuted that energy to make himself into the man that he became.
Absolutely. And so you see him already in his Freshers' Week, turning up to Cambridge and all of the things. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, Lord Byron, but you're not allowed a dog on the campus. So he brought a bear, you know, these are the sorts of things.
Yeah, and even at Harrow, he turned up as an outsider. Bear in mind, despite being an aristocrat, he wasn't wealthy until very, very recently. So this wealth allowed him to go to Harrow. It allowed him to move his mother into Newstead.
Yes.
And it allowed him to actually have a dignified life. She became re-involved in the aristocratic circles, which she couldn't be involved in anymore because of her loss of wealth. And social status due to his father. So when he arrived at Harrow, he was kind of on the outside. And obviously, Regency private schools. Private schools don't have a good reputation these days. So imagine what they were like back then. So he was quite quickly bullied, but he was strong enough within himself to resist that, and strong enough as well to stick up for other people who were bullied. So he was very much an outsider, and very much his own man. Even at a young age at Harrow and later Cambridge.
Yes. And also as well, certainly at his time at Cambridge, he managed to cultivate around him a circle of friends who were, how to put it, on the more radical end of the current issues of the day. You know, these were men who were Republicans and atheists. And obviously, to be an atheist or a Republican or both at that time was to be associated with Jacobinism. It was to be associated with the worst excesses of the French Revolution.
Yeah.
And to basically be someone who was a subversive, someone who was wanting to undermine the traditional institutions of society and the morality that those social institutions preached. And this would have been something that would have been even harder in Byron's day, because of course during that time with Pitt the Younger as prime minister and many of the sort, it's anachronistic, but the Tory light, you know, what would become the figures of the Tory party later on with Robert Peel, you know, the precursors to them, who were in obviously total confrontation against the French Revolution, were very, very, they weren't afraid of using censorship.
Oh, yeah.
They weren't afraid of shutting down the social clubs for the revolutionary types in English society at the time. And Byron was really personally rankled by what he saw as this repression.
Yeah, he was completely on board with the Irish.
Yeah.
Who were obviously repressed as part of this.
Yes.
He was very, very intense in his defence of the Irish and Irish emancipation, or his Catholic emancipation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so basically he formed a set of friends that would no doubt go on to form. Well, we see here certainly many of these themes coming through in particularly the first canto, where he's looking at France and Spain and England all in conflict with one another in the Peninsular War, and looking at the reasons for why this war is happening, who this war is being fought in the name of, what are the elite interests that this war actually serves, and to what extent is this war actually good for the common people?
Mm.
And you see him scrutinising a lot of those decisions later on.
He's very much against the idea of glory for the sake of glory.
Mm.
He's very much on board with violence and sacrificing large numbers of people in order, if the aim is liberation,
honourable
liberty,
yeah.
But when it's for imperial gains or just gains of glory, which are later to be lost due to diplomatic things, diplomatic decisions,
yes,
it's all for nothing, and he's very much against that because this is kind of like contradiction within him, where he's very, very pro Napoleon, especially when he's younger, but as he grows older and Napoleon goes into exile and comes out of exile and whatnot, and acts in a way that Byron sees as not only tyrannical but dishonorable. Dishonorable. He looks at this Napoleonic ideal as something that hasn't been seen in Europe, and he looks more to people like George Washington as a representation of that ideal.
Yes,
it's all about liberty for him.
Yeah,
and he's quite a humanist in a lot of ways.
Mm.
He's quite humanistic in his love of democracy and sort of republicanism as well.
Yeah, well, certainly unequivocally against absolute monarchy.
Yeah.
In all its forms. I mean, you look at people as well that Byron commented on, such as Frederick the Great, who for the time was seen as the enlightened despot, the enlightened absolute monarch of his day. And though Byron certainly thought that Frederick the Great stood apart against other monarchs of his time, his critique was not with the person, but with the actual status.
Yeah, the institution.
The institution itself.
He doesn't see aristocratic rank as legitimate. It's what you do with it.
Yeah.
It's the person.
Right. And the other thing as well, just to say, that despite the fact that, you know, Byron was, of course, probably the most famous Casanova of his day, there is also the other end of that as well, which is actually the fact that far from being an absolute tearaway who slept with endless numbers of women and wasn't afraid to, you know, stand up to people and get into fights with people and lived all of the things that you think about when you think of the words mad, bad and dangerous.
Mm.
There is also the other side of that, which actually it gave Byron a great amount of wisdom for why those things are perhaps not the way.
Yeah.
And actually later in his life, he came to regret some of his the earlier ways in which he lived. In fact, in this very way, his involvement at the early stages of the Greek War of Independence, which Byron would die in, for Byron was kind of, in a way, not entirely, but something of an atonement.
Yeah.
It was a way to do something with his life that actually would have a lasting effect as something, a force for good in the world outside of his own quest for pleasure and experience.
Yeah.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.